Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Webber, alongside me for one more time consistently, Mr. Chad. We will miss him, Riley.
Hi, yeah, I'm here and then I'm gone. But I'll be back every once in a while.
Today is a special episode as we will be talking about that part after we talk about the part that we're here for. But also with us is Mr. Spencer... I can't see him, Williams.
What?
He keeps trying to look around the screen, and he doesn't quite have the range.
Chad, when you leave, this podcast is going down the toilet.
That's such a nice thing to say, Spencer. Thank you.
Well, we got a great show in store for you, as we will be talking about the recently released Dark Phoenix, the latest entry into the X-Men saga. So stick around as we talk about that, but before we do, Chad... give it to us one more time.
With all the genetics-altering power of a so-called solar storm, the Filmlosophers podcast is brought to you by Mingle Media TV and VGB Studios. New episodes drop like your pull list of new comics each Wednesday morning and stream on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom.
Family is important, and you're definitely a member of ours. Well, in a virtual sense.
Of course.
And one that doesn't get any money. Connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Finally, we wanted to point out that our website has an episode count that would easily rival anything that you'd see on the class list at the Xavier Institute for Gifted Youngsters. And they're more fun than the classroom lectures, too.
Yeah, of course they are.
You can access our entire list of episodes on filmlosophers.com.
That's right. You can check out all over 160 different episodes where you can take a look, listen to us, hear us make fun of ourselves, make fun of movies, and gush about everything else that we love.
It's a lot going on.
There really is a lot going on. And we had a great episode last week at Lesson 164 where we talked about Godzilla. So that was pretty fun. Check that out after this episode, because in this episode we are talking about Dark Phoenix.
Kaka.
No. not their sound effect.
It was close. I mean, hey.
Was it?
I don't know what a phoenix no. sounds like, so I don't know what to say.
I would guess not kaka.
I don't know. Have you ever met a phoenix?
In Albus Dumbledore's office once. There you go.
This film, one of the more recent entries, actually probably the last entry that still holds the Fox name to it out of the X-Men saga. It's been long awaited. There's been so many different things going on the back end of this film in terms of release dates and reshoots and everything that we finally get a chance to see this movie, and we are kind of excited to talk about it because Of the three of us here, I think Chad is probably the biggest X-Men, and I mean this as a term of endearment, but an X-Men nerd when it comes to this
totally.
Particular franchise. So before we get
into... Yeah, I grew up reading the comic books, so they're near and dear to my heart.
Well, I'm glad to hear that because we aren't going to be... I know I have a lot of questions out of this movie. So before we get into the review, Chad, give us that official synopsis goodness.
During a life-threatening rescue mission in space, Jean Grey is hit by a cosmic force that transforms her into one of the most powerful mutants of all. Wrestling with this increasingly unstable power, as well as her own personal demons, Jean spirals out of control, tearing the X-Men family apart and threatening to destroy the very fabric of our planet.
You're tearing me apart, Jean!
No.
How
dare you?
Boo!
Directed and written by Simon Kinberg, the film stars James McAvoy, Michael Fassbender, Jennifer Lawrence, Nicholas Holt, Sophie Turner, Ty Sheridan, Alexandra Shipp, Cody Smith McPhee, Evan Peters, and Jessica Chastain. If you're unaware, the music you were actually listening to was done by the notorious and wonderfully incredible Hans Zimmer. So Hans Zimmer actually decided to retire from composing superhero movies after having worked on movies like Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, and Spider-Man. But for whatever reason, whatever he did, Simon Kinberg actually convinced him to work on this movie. So I'm thinking like he convinced him with money? I can't think of any reason.
Quite possibly.
Blackmail. It's always a strong contender.
Blackmail.
Yeah.
So what did you think he had on him? He's like, I bet you don't use real instruments. It's all on a keyboard. I'm going to tell the world.
That would be such a scandal.
It's like, you're no real composer. It's all from Christopher Columbus. So,
what?
Chris Columbus.
Oh, okay.
The dude.
I thought you were talking about...
Yes, about the explorer, Christopher Columbus. Yes, Hans Zimmer took all of his ideas from the explorer.
He was way ahead of his time.
A couple of information about the numbers. The budget for this film was estimated around $200 million, and the domestic opening weekend thus far, because we are recording this episode during the course of the weekend, is $33 million as of today. So the worldwide totals as of today equal to about $140 million, which...
So it's doing a lot better overseas than it's doing here. That is not a good opening number for a summer blockbuster positioned film.
Well, and I think a lot of it, too... goes to when this film screened with the press and so forth, there was not a lot of good reception. Like, just being frank, like a lot of the people that I were seeing and reading, I didn't read any spoiler ones, but just like the headlines, like, oh, Dark Phoenix X, Y, and Z, or Dark Phoenix blah, 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 or Foxes, whatever. Like, not a lot of them were being very gracious to the movie, in all frank.
No, and it's one of those things that One of the issues they had, this film was originally slated to come out, I think, in November of 2018. And it got pushed back, and a lot of that was probably, you know, behind-the-scenes stuff. Fox and Disney working out their deal and whatever was going to happen there. But because of that, so they had a thing behind the scenes where they're like, well, near the end of the movie, there's something that we chose to do before we saw Avengers Infinity War. But then when we saw Avengers Infinity War, we thought, oh, well, that's interesting that a certain element seemed to play out very similarly.
Mm-hmm.
And so they redid part of the ending as a result. And, you know, all the reshoots and everything, and then they rescheduled. But I think, judging by what the final product looks like at the end, I think it actually would have been better still to stick with the November release date and go between Infinity War and Endgame.
Yeah.
Because Infinity War was out the gate first, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
It was slated for earlier in the year and everything. And so you get that story element, that effect, really, with Infinity War. And then if you had followed up totally unintentionally, but sort of almost like you meant to do it with this in November, leading into Endgame, the Endgame hype would have been even higher than it was.
Yeah.
In terms of integrating the universes and whatever, just purely from a visual standpoint.
Oh, yeah.
Not even a storytelling. It's not a plot point. We'll get to it later because, you know, we're talking spoilers.
We're going to be talking spoilers today.
But I don't want to give it away right away. But it's really more a visual effect tie-in. I mean, I guess it depends on what originally felt like, because they did change the ending.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, the visual effect tie-in, I think, would have actually been even, like, people would have gone to see this more in November than they will now, because it would have looked like it was intentionally paralleling some of Infinity War.
Yeah, true. And I think this particular film, I think the fact that this is the second time that they're attacking the Phoenix persona or character, however you want to portray it.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just be frank. There was no way in the world they were going to do worse than the first time they tried to portray
Totally
them.
True.
Not to knock on any of those performers in that film, but that film in its entirety was just bad altogether.
Yeah.
So...
X-Men The Last Stand, by the way, is what he's referring to.
Which we won't
2006.
Touch. We will not touch with a 50-foot pole.
13 years is not long enough.
No. So to see them re-enter that particular storyline, which there's a really deep thread to this storyline. Like I'm vaguely familiar, but if I'm right, Chad, like this storyline isn't just a single incident. Like it spans over the course of years in the comics.
Oh, for sure. The Dark Phoenix comic book storyline is the story for the X-Men line, even to this day. I mean, certainly things have happened since then, but still, like, Dark Phoenix was a defining moment. You took a character who was the heartbeat, beloved character on the team and turned her evil beyond her control of what was going on. And then in the comics, they put her on trial on the moon and sentence her to execution. So there are certain things.
They have a trial for her on the moon?
Well, yes. I'm just going to, I'm not going to get into it. Yes. Yes, they have a trial for her. The trial takes place on the moon. There are characters in the Marvel Comics universe who live on the dark side of the moon because we never see it. Yeah, the Inhumans.
Okay.
There's a whole city there. It's a whole thing, right? So that's not the way that that story has been told or has been set up in any way. So you really couldn't go that far. Yeah. Also, the Inhumans are very securely, we're already in the Marvel Studios toy bin, so to speak, in terms of you're allowed to talk about them and Fox is not. So, you know, but there are other things that really could have and should have been integrated here that I think a lot of people before the movie dropped, it's like, okay, so are you going to like fully loop in the Hellfire Club? Are you going to fully loop in the Shi'ar Empire of, you know, from outer space?
Yeah.
And they do loop in alien characters, but they're not the Shi'ar, which are the ones that are most closely tied to Phoenix lore and pursuing the Phoenix and, you know, whatever.
Uh-huh.
They choose a different, lesser known alien race for this storyline, which also has ties to the Phoenix Force, but it just, they made some interesting choices. I think one of the very blanket statement, now that we're, you know, very realistically at the end of Fox's stewardship of these characters.
Yeah.
One of the really broad overarching themes that sticks out is how much liberty the creators take with these stories. The beginning of the Phoenix story here in Dark Phoenix matches a lot more closely, like way closer to what happens in the comic books than the Last Stand even tried to do. However, they are still messing with Jean Grey's childhood story in ways that are not authentic to the way it's told in the comic books. And I think as a comic book fan, specifically of the X-Men, I still am like, why? Why did you do that? The payoff, we'll get into it, but they did it because of the way they've structured these characters in this story versus what her actual backstory is from the comics, where she's really not like an evil child. Like, she never was. So, anyway, there was a tragedy in her childhood, and Xavier helped her get over that. That part is true. But both parts of the Fox movie sequence, so you've got the first trilogy, and then you've got this second, what do you call a quartet? I don't know. They both have been now at this point treating Jean as a trouble child.
Yeah.
And that's part of what goes into the whole Phoenix thing. And that's not really authentic to the way that it played out, at least not to my recollection. I haven't read every single book, but read a lot.
Yeah. So, Spence, because I know your information on a lot of these comic book movies isn't sincerely based in the comic books because you didn't read them.
Yeah.
But you are familiar, though. How much of the Last Stand storyline do you remember?
Enough to be very concerned when the first trailers for this movie came out.
Okay.
Because I just didn't want to revisit that story at all. Because, like, 13 years is not enough time. Like, we need maybe decades. Like,
you know, a lot of decades from that mess.
So I really wasn't, like, all of my information about Phoenix comes from there. So that's a really bad starting point also. So I had bad intel on what the Phoenix was even supposed to be. And I was not looking forward to this movie.
This particular one in itself.
Yeah, just because of the subject matter. Plus, while this series has done better with characters than the previous one has at certain aspects.
Yeah.
I was still concerned if they were going to do this correctly for people who knew more than me. And also not make it a mess for people like me who don't know what's going on and can't fill in the gaps.
So do you think you felt, so you were concerned ultimately because of the fact that they were going to revisit this storyline is what I'm gathering.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. In terms of like storyline, my knowledge, which is why I have to ask Chad. Chad is like seriously the go-to for comics. I will call him in the middle of the night and say, Chad, I know it's 2 a.m, but I couldn't figure out what is the name of this one character that was in that one comic book.
And I'll say, go to sleep.
And then I'll hang up the phone and call him back 5 minutes later. Sorry. So, but like I've seen a lot of the cartoons. I've read a few of the comics that are more recent, probably from like 2000s on. I'm aware of like the recent iterations of the Phoenix Force and the utilization of it and thus far. To be quite frank, like the origins of this story still eludes me, like of how the comic book originally pitted it. And so watching kind of in the same like shoes that Spence is in, my mindset immediately goes to when I hear the Phoenix Force or Dark Phoenix in the X-Men, I immediately go to X-Men Last Stand. And I cringe because...
That's so unfortunate. That's lamentable.
And it's not because that's the only thing I choose to run it towards. It's because it's the only thing I have.
Oh, and Simon Kinberg wrote that one too.
Did he?
Yeah.
He's
been writing these things for a long time.
Both of these movies have the same writer.
Yeah. I mean, he was part of a team, but this one, he's the director also. He's the writer and the director. But he's been writing on the X-Men movies almost the entire time they've been making X-Men movies.
Huh.
He's one of the most consistent members of the team.
Oh, my gosh. He is one of the writers.
Yeah. Now, that doesn't excuse what Brett Ratner came in and did.
Exactly. Yeah. I was going to say.
But I remember back in the day when it was in pre-production. It was script phase only, and it hadn't yet received the green light.
Uh-huh.
Somebody leaked... I want to say it was Ain't It Cool News or something, you know, again, back in the day. Somebody leaked a synopsis of the script that was in, like, workshop mode. Because, I mean, you know, movie gets made. You might see, like, 1 to 3 writers credited. That probably means 30 people touched it in different ways and, like, did things on contract behind the scenes and didn't have the iteration that finally went to production or whatever. So you've got a lot more creative voices working on a script than just the few that get credited at the end. It's all this weird stuff that happens to figure out who gets credit and who doesn't. But
yeah.
Anyway, somebody received a workshopping ready script and they're like, yeah, in this script, would you believe it? They kill Cyclops. They kill Xavier. Juggernaut has a big role and doesn't really make any sense. And the Phoenix is really like a bipolar, like, alter ego thing for Jean Grey. Can you believe that's where they're at right now? Good thing they're workshopping it. And then like a year later, you see the finished movie and you're like, oh my gosh, they didn't fix any of that. They kept all of that in there.
Oh my gosh. And that was for the 2006 movie?
Yeah, that was for The Last Stand.
Oh my gosh. What? That's like being forewarned. Don't go through. The bridge is out. The bridge is out. And like, oh, well, they'll finish it by the time I get there. And
yeah, but I think there's something to be said about when it's written out as like simple one-sentence statements. Like, this happens, that happens. And you look at that in like all in like a quarter of a page and like, that's ridiculous. Nobody should make that movie. But because it was like pages and pages and pages and voices and people working on it, somehow all that stuff stuck. I don't know why.
Oh, my gosh.
This movie, so Simon Kinberg then, yeah. Same writer, but he's trying again, and he's in the director's chair, which apparently was a thing behind the scenes where some of the big stars of the First Class sequence said, hey, if you take over as director, then we'll give it a shot again, but otherwise, no. And so that's what they did. And that's how you get, like, McAvoy, Fassbender, and Lawrence back for this one. And Holt, because they kind of had a, I don't know, like a blood pact or something. If one decides not to come back, then none of them come back.
Oh, wow. There you go. In terms of expectations for the film, excuse me, one of the biggest things that I really was hoping to see with this one, because of the fact that we were hitting that kind of momentous moment of the final Fox X-Men film. Because if we look at the history of X-Men, since the very first film back in 2000, I believe. It was 2000?
Mm-hmm. It was.
From 2000 all the way up until now, Fox has held the keys to the X-Men kingdom for 19 years.
Yeah, and they've held them more securely than anything else
yeah.
that they had from the Marvel Comics universe.
Oh, yeah, because they had Spider-Man in the beginning, and then that went to Sony. And then the Fantastic Four, which... yeah. So if you're looking at kind of the franchise that kind of sparked the larger interest in comic book movies in this generation of movies and film, it was Fox, and it was the X-Men.
It was
franchise.
X-Men in 2000, yeah. So, it totally reignited.
Yeah. Because you had the smaller little things throughout the course of the 90s. Like, you had Blade, who did his thing. You had the unassuming, which was probably, I think, late 80s, early 90s, Howard the Duck film that was not even...
Well, that was always made for a fringe audience anyway.
That really was.
I mean, really, comic book movies were in an okay state until Schumacher. Joel Schumacher did Batman Forever, which was still okay, and yeah. then Batman and Robin, which killed everything. It all died.
Bad nipples.
It was so bad. And,
yeah.
And so there was a lot of hesitation on, yeah. like, wait a minute, do we want to still keep making these kinds of movies? And so you had your, like, Blade, also more of a fringe entry
yep.
than, like, a main line, not... You know, just, I mean, it's vampires and superheroes and dark and whatever. Like, it's just not exactly mainstream.
No, not at
all.
Quote
unquote mainstream. So X-Men then was like, the studios are looking around saying, okay, well, Marvel's willing to share their characters now to start doing for real movies. Like, who do we want to start with? Well, X-Men makes a lot of sense because they kind of ruled the 90s in yeah. the comic book world. I mean... Huge numbers in comic sales. The cartoon series definitely boosted our young minds, you know, interest and exposure to yeah. to that IP, the intellectual property. So the X-Men were huge in the 90s,
well, not
especially
to mention,
Wolverine.
Not to mention the uptick because of technology moving forward, the uptick in video games and
oh, yeah.
video game ports for from these particular franchises and brands. I mean, you had the X-Men video games, you had... all these other types of video games that were coming about and becoming more and more popular. And moving from systems like Nintendo all the way through to like Super Nintendos and Sega Genesis and Sega Saturns and things like that, the technology moved with it and you were having more and more fun with that particular character that you really liked. So
totally.
That also added to a lot of the allure because I know, oddly enough, you know, we're recording in VGB Studios again, and for VGB, that's what they kind of talk about in terms of the video game aspect, but it is an important part of the exposure, as Chad put it, to these particular characters and this particular franchise for the recognition and for people to actually come on board when, come the year 2000, you present a film that is based on your favorite cartoon characters from your Saturday morning cartoons and the video games that you played, and it was an easy sell.
But I think this is super important from the comics because, yes, the cartoon and the video games and the lunchboxes and whatever, those were like the gateway drug.
Of course.
People read these comics. The numbers on X-Men comics and their related properties were like bonkers good. compared to pretty much anything else that any other publishing house was putting out.
Yeah.
So it got kids at the right time where they're like, okay, maybe I don't like reading, you know, short stories in English class in school or whatever, but these comic books have pictures and words, and there are so many of them. Like, you can go back and look at old ones if you want to. The X-Men wing of Marvel Publishing exploded. It had like more like 24 titles at one point, all publishing. Yeah. And now they kind of all go that way and try to do that to capitalize on moments in the movies and characters that come to prominence and all of that through the MCU. Not to knock that, because that's an extraordinary effort they've put forward, and they've really nailed it the whole time so far in almost every respect. But for the X-Men, like for kids like me and a lot of my friends, yeah, we saw it on a Saturday morning cartoon or in a video game or whatever, but we also went and compelled our parents to buy the comic book issues because the readership numbers were off the charts. It was so good.
Yeah.
So then you take that property, that intellectual property, the IP, and you say, okay, if we're going to make a movie about anything, we need to make a movie about these characters because it hasn't been done live action, and maybe they could reignite the comic book movie genre, if you will. And so they did it. They happened to super luck out with the way that they cast Wolverine, in my opinion. But they also monkeyed a lot with the way that the characters work, from like the way that they were written in the comics to the way that they're presented in the movies. And in some respects, it really works, because you don't want to make an X-Men movie, like a foundational, formational X-Men movie, without Storm. Storm is one of the most important characters in all of comic books, and always will be. So the fact that, you know, in the comics, she wasn't actually one of the founding members, neither was Wolverine of the X-Men, but they put them in there right from the start because they know that they're very popular characters for good reason. So, you know, they monkeyed with some things that make a lot of sense, but then I think when you do get to the first class set of films, they monkey with a whole lot more, and that becomes really apparent when you get down to, well, X-Men Apocalypse, which was one of our earliest episodes, Eddie, Lesson 13. And then when you get to this movie, Dark Phoenix, they're trying the most popular storyline for a second time because they biffed it so hard the first time. But they have a, like, it's different. Like, the way that they've built the world is different. The way the characters work with each other is different. Who the characters in the spotlight are is different in many ways. And so it's really hard. It's like a square peg round hole situation. It's hard, really, to get there at this point.
What about you, Spence? What were some of your expectations coming into this particular film, aside from hoping not to see a rehash of The Last Stand?
No, that's literally it.
We've been jaded, Spence. We know.
Well, because, like, for a good reason, like, after The Last Stand happened, no one was going to really, like, make another media property with the Phoenix in it if that was going to be, like, their only reference point.
Yeah.
But that leads into the problem of now, that's my only reference point still. So, like, I don't know. I was just not super excited to see this movie. That was my expectation.
All right, well.
I was trying to be open, though. Open to
his expectation was, I'm going to be sad in the theater. That's all I know.
So a normal week.
Yeah.
That's what I'm hearing.
Pretty much.
You know, sometimes that strategy really works well, though, when it's like, go in with low expectations, and then something that's mediocre has a chance of actually landing well.
That actually is very true.
Yeah. And it's sad to say that, like, just I just have to agree with Spence on this one, because it's like, I just don't want to see The Last Stand anymore, please. Chad, what about you? What were some of your biggest expectations for this particular movie?
I just hope that they did it better. The Last Stand was so bad. Like, especially the Phoenix part of it. The Phoenix part of it was the worst. And yes, it had the drama and the characters, you know, weeping over Xavier getting vaporized or whatever, you know, like, but it was so bad. It was so off. It was like, just call her a different character. Like, you've made a completely different character. This is not the Phoenix. That's not what it ever was. The Phoenix was always some otherworldly,
yeah,
OP entity, right? Overpowered. Like, it eats planets and destroys them.
Mm-hmm.
Dead, gone. Like, that's what it does. That's its MO. And it's coming toward the Earth next, right? Like, that's a completely different dynamic than, oh yeah, that's the shadow self of this really strong mind-reading lady.
Yeah.
This is what happens when her meds wear off and she goes psycho crazy. Like, no, it's just, it's
so
a
accurate.
Totally different,
so
it's a totally different character. So yeah, The Last Stand was awful. I, going into this movie, was just hoping they didn't do anything remotely like that. Which, some of the trailers didn't give me a lot to hope on, because it's clear that she's losing her sanity.
Yeah.
But even in the comics, when she's literally possessed by this thing. This thing possesses and takes over her body. So, it's not really Jean Grey anymore. Mm-hmm. It's the, I guess you could call it, the personality of the Phoenix that takes over her body, her abilities, etc.
Yeah.
So it would make sense in what we saw in the trailers. I thought, okay, well, maybe they're doing that kind of thing, because she's got the, like, cracks in her skin that are forming, and it's like, it's wanting to burst out at any moment, and somehow her body is keeping it contained, but it still isn't Jean that's talking, it's the Phoenix, you know, because it is this weird, it's trying to pretend like it's her, but it isn't. So, you know, I thought, well, at least they have to have learned their lesson. They have to. It was so bad.
Nobody has to learn anything. That's what I've learned in life.
Wow. Well, obviously, jumping into this movie, you have a lot of returning characters from the last film. You have Professor Charles Xavier, played by James McAvoy. Eric Lenchers, played by Michael Fassbender. That's also Magneto. Mystique is Jennifer Lawrence. You have a lot of the returning characters. One of the characters that actually surprised me, not in the fact that he returned, no, but like in his ability to kind of take the lead in terms of his role, because in the previous film, he kind of really played that side character. I honestly thought Nicholas Holt really stuck out a little bit more in this movie, which is the character who plays Hank McCoy or Beast.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there was a little bit more like opportunity for him to kind of stand out. Ty Sheridan is kind of known for that single tier kind of thing constantly. I've already seen him do that once in the X-Men film before this one in Ready Player One, and then he did it again in this one. So, I'm not saying he's a one-trick pony, but
you've only seen one trick so far.
I've only seen one trick, but I gotta
give a fair assessment.
I gotta give Nicholas Holt props, because he started out a little bit more mild mannered in the first one. The second one, there was a little bit more progression of his character, especially with the connection between him and Mystique, and then his kind of coming into him being his own character in this one really shone brighter than the previous two films, and I gotta give him the props for that.
Well, and he's one of those characters that somehow has almost come, not full circle, but has actually changed. Like,
yeah.
The way that he behaves in this movie, especially, you know, in some of the bits that you're referring to, it really is fundamentally different than what he was before. And you've kind of seen him moving along a path versus, like, just regurgitating the same thing all the time.
Very true.
Like, he actually has, there's been some nuance and some detail that's woven into his story thread, which is really great, because in the comics, Beast really is the one, because he's so intellectual, but then so monstrous in his appearance and everything, but you know, warm and friendly. He is the one who routinely questions the leadership of the X-Men on whether they're doing the right thing or not. And then, of course, he tries to intervene in different scientific ways, and those never really go right. So it's a terrible idea. But, I mean, he's been an Avenger in the comics.
Yeah.
He's been, what is it? The Defender, I think, maybe, I don't know. He's been on other teams. He's formed friendships, some of them very close, with other characters in the publishing house, totally outside of the X-Men.
Oh, wow.
So he really is. He's been for many, many years a versatile character in the comics who's not afraid to question what they're doing and opt out. He's left the X-Men more than once and said, nope, I'm not on board with this, bye. And so, like, some of that texture, some of that shading of the character you really see here, and I thought it was good because it was authentic to what we've seen in the source material, and it worked within the context of the story that they've been telling with these four movies.
Plus, Spence, he grows up and turns into Kelsey Grammer, so there you go.
You know, Kelsey Grammer was a great choice for Beast back in the day.
He really was. I liked him.
He's great.
And then, of course, we have, like we mentioned, the return of Jennifer Lawrence in the role of Mystique, which...
Can you hear my eyes roll?
His eyes are rolling so hard in the studio. Oh, my goodness. And it's funny because Spencer kind of asked a question before we...
Okay, I asked it before, so it wouldn't be on the podcast.
I have to say, though, it is something worth mentioning. He asked... Had Jennifer Lawrence always been in this this trilogy? And of course, obviously, the answer was yes, she'd always been. But I did give him the benefit of the doubt because of the fact that her look has changed so drastically from the very first one.
She looks wildly different.
First Class, not the very first one. Yes. That was Rebecca Romijn. But, from First Class up till now.
And... it's like night and day. Like, Jennifer Lawrence then looks...
She doesn't look like Jennifer Lawrence. Currently, she looks like Jennifer Lawrence. I can make that, like, association. But before this, no.
Yeah, it's almost kind of scary as to, like, how they had her portrayed in that particular movie. Like, her forehead is, like, super huge. She's got, like, overly usage of, like, the scales on her head. We're actually looking at a picture of her in studio. Plus... as was stated earlier, she wore less clothes back then, but they're letting her wear a lot more clothes in the more recent ones, which, like, it's just so weird. Like, everything looks just so creepy.
If anything, it kind of reminds me more of the original actress from the first trilogy.
Yeah, Rebecca Romijn.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the character design for that movie, for Mystique, was... wildly different than anything we'd ever seen for Mystique in the comics. Like, Mystique does not do that look ever. She has this weird, like, flowy white dress thing with a skull belt.
Yeah.
And so, and a forehead, like, emblem of some sort. She's a bad guy.
Right.
She's really, like, occasionally she helps them, but she's a bad guy at heart. And so... in First Class, where they wrote in this whole new backstory where Mystique and Charles Xavier knew each other as kids and were basically like brother and sister kind of all growing up and all that. And they're paying that off in this movie. And it's like, but that was never, hard to buy because as a fan, like that's never been the case in the comic books. Have they worked together before? Yes. Was that the end of it? Absolutely. But in these movies, they're positioned very differently. And Mystique is like, as of Days of Future Past, she's kind of like the mutant messiah, like the spokesperson for, like, be proud of being different and whatever. Like, she could have killed the president and didn't, you know? And, like, it was this whole, all of it has dramatically shifted the storytelling landscape.
Yeah.
Like, far away from... what you've got in the comic book series, which isn't a problem because all it needs to do is maintain its own continuity within this movie sequence. It needs to stay related to itself.
Yeah.
But the further that you get from the source material, I think the harder that is to accomplish.
Yeah.
And I think some of that really shows in this movie. I wouldn't say that Dark Phoenix is... like one of the worst in the franchise overall. I don't think it's one of the best. I think it lands solidly somewhere in the middle.
I agree.
It held my interest. It did some different things with some characters that we've seen a lot by now. But at the same time, it was like, I just feel like I was missing something. Like by the end of the whole thing, I don't know, like, it's just like, I feel like there was an opportunity or five that you had and you didn't take. Yeah. And I don't know what they were.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, I think continuing on the arc of, like, following suit with certain character arcs that have already been established. Say, for instance, like you mentioned with Mystique, like one of the biggest things that I had always worried about in the original trilogy was that there was no information in terms of creating the connection between Mystique in the comics and the cartoon being the mother of Rogue. That was never...
Adoptive mother, but yes.
But that was...
She's in the comics, she's the birth mother of Nightcrawler.
Nightcrawler. Mm.
And the adoptive mother of Rogue. Yes. And they did not grow up together. Nightcrawler was basically, like, dumped off, kind of like the Penguin in the Batman movies. Like, yeah. Just, like, left somewhere.
Dumped at a circus.
And so he grew up in the circus, right? He doesn't know for a long time that his mom is Mystique.
Yeah.
Mystique falls in love with an older woman named Irene, who's prophetess, basically. She can see the future. She goes by the name Destiny. She falls in love. Mystique falls in love with this woman, and they adopt a young girl with that skunk stripe in her hair and raise her from, like, I don't know, age 8 on, and raise her to be a member of their villain group. So Rogue was a bad guy to begin with.
Yeah.
And she was like a preteen, essentially. She was like a 14-year-old bad guy, and she was really good at it. But yeah, Mystique and Irene were her adoptive parents, essentially, for several years while she was a youngster in the comics. Never been the way they tell the story.
No, not at all.
In the movie universe, and it would be really difficult. You'd have to really focus on Rogue.
Yeah.
To do that any justice and have it matter in the broader scheme of things.
Yeah. And in all honesty, in this particular film, in Dark Phoenix, Mystique, you can tell that Jennifer Lawrence wanted to make sure this was going to be the last time she did this particular character. Now, if anybody's familiar with the debacle that happened when The Force Awakens was coming about, everybody knew Harrison Ford had, you know, yelled it to from one end of the earth to the other that he was never going to do another Star Wars film, that he was done playing the role of Han Solo. He wouldn't do it again. He didn't have any interest to do it again. So it was odd that he eagerly picked up the role to do Han Solo for The Force Awakens and to allow his character to be reprised. Well, it came to find out that at the end of The Force Awakens, obviously, spoiler alert if you haven't seen it for all these years, but that's all on you. At the end of The Force Awakens, Han Solo was killed. He's ran through with his son's blade. The fact that, I say all that to say, the fact that Jennifer Lawrence was eager to jump back into this particular project, although she had spoken openly about not wanting to do another X-Men film, kind of mirrored that a bit of Harrison Ford. And it is paid off in terms of your suspicions, because as the film goes on, one of the inciting incidences that kind of pushed Jean to the nth degree of her mental instability is the fact that Jean causes Mystique to die. I say all that to say.
I like the dramatic pause to collapse in a puddle of goo.
Exactly. That is her.
That's blood. Not actually what she does.
No.
But she kills her.
Yeah. And it's, I feel like there's a lot of doors closing for this particular franchise for the opportunities to carry over what is already established to Disney. Which, mind you, that's fine. That's all on, you know, Disney's job to figure out how they're going to recreate that franchise. But it is interesting that they're making efforts, like they're killing off her. With the way this film ends, they're doing that. There's just so many doors that are kind of closing and so many opportunities that are collapsing that. Do you think, Chad, that they're just going to completely wipe the slate clean and start anew with Disney? Or do you
totally
think, you really do think
absolutely
so?
Yeah.
Spence, you sound like you agree.
Yeah, because it'd be crazy not to. Like, if you're Disney, you have one of two choices. You can either just start over again,
uh-huh,
or you can, for some reason, use what Fox has left over and just be like, it's a parallel universe, they're stuck here or something. Which would be wild and crazy because then they're stuck with After Dark Phoenix and nobody wants to be in that position.
I see what you're saying. Okay. So,
well, it also
makes a good point now that you say that.
If you do that, you're also tied to everything that's come before.
Yeah.
And they're going to need to do something different.
Another Days of Future Past.
Exactly. Future Past. It's such a mess already.
We messed up
I
again.
I say that lovingly. There's never to me, nope, I was about to say something inaccurate. I was going to say, to me, there's never been a Batman and Robin of the X-Men franchise. I'm wrong. Wolverine Origins is the Batman and Robin of the franchise. So never mind. There has been, but that one's easily forgotten.
Like, I've seen none of the Wolverine movies, probably for the best.
Oh my gosh, that Wolverine, that Origins, X-Men Origins Wolverine is so bad. If you ever want to see probably like horrible CG work done on a film that is marketed as one of the Marvel films, that is the one to go to because those claws look horrendous.
So bad.
So bad.
Isn't that the one?
That's the one where he's in the bathroom and he's looking at his claws and... Like the chin.
They change shape and it's like Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Oh no.
Claws.
It's pretty bad.
I was gonna say,
like,
isn't
literal
that
cartoon.
The one with Ryan Reynolds in it?
Yes.
Yeah.
His first go at Deadpool.
Yeah, that's
But that wasn't his fault. They changed it. They used a popular name and a very basic description of the power set, and then they made a totally different character. They had a really bad habit of that, actually, as turns out.
There you go, Spence. That is an actual cut from the scene from the film. Those claws, that's the way they looked.
Okay, see, this just looks like you photoshopped in some claws in a different Hugh Jackman movie of some sort.
That's the way they looked in the movie.
Oh, that's bad.
Like,
yeah, it was...
You couldn't even tell what he was looking like. Look at his eyes.
Again.
His eyes are looking at his fingers, not even looking at his claws.
Well, because he pricks his finger, doesn't he?
He does something. I don't know.
Because, we've spent too long talking about it already. But, yeah, I think that there's room in any of these adaptations, any adaptation ever. You are working with a different storytelling medium than where it started. If that's a book, a stage play, a song, whatever, even a documentary. A documentary has 2 hours or an hour and a half. It doesn't have 8 years or however long the actual proceedings took place, you know, whatever you're recounting. So the fact that you've got time constraints, you've got some, you know, storytelling needs and whatever, creative liberty is the name of the game. You're going to tell your story the way you're going to tell your story. However, I think that oftentimes within the X-Men set of films, they take creative liberty and then they take more creative liberty. Until they get to a point where they're really just saying, here's this famous person, and here's that famous person. What can we have them do with each other in a scene? And the name of the character and the power set are recognizable, but the way that it's all thrown together is just like, why did you do that? Like, lean into the characters, not the powers.
Yeah.
Like, lean into who the characters are. And I can see that they made that attempt here because, once again, you've got flashback to when Jean Grey was a little girl and apparently very troubled. The movie starts with, like, she causes a car accident.
Yeah.
Not intentionally, but not exactly unintentionally. But she causes a car accident that she's the sole survivor of.
Yeah.
And she's in the hospital, and that's where she meets Xavier, who still has his hair at that point. And he says, you know, basically, like, I can help you. And, you know, so begins her journey through, you know, the Xavier Institute for Gifted Youngsters. But in the comics, it really wasn't that sinister.
Yeah.
She, unfortunately, because she's a telepath, she can hear people's thoughts and read their minds and whatnot. In the comics, either her sister or her best friend, I think it was her sister, died unexpectedly. And because she was a youngster, burgeoning telepath, she experienced her sister's death or her best friend's death as if she was in that person's mind and she barely got out of it. So that was the traumatic backstory for Jean Grey.
Yeah.
But in both iterations, I guess you could pretty accurately say under Simon Kinberg's pen stroke, she's been like a demented little girl.
Yeah. It's true.
It's different.
It really is. And it's... See, the way you're saying it, it makes a lot more sense to then separate the two. Jean Grey and the Phoenix Force itself.
Because they're not the same.
They're not the same. So here's the thing. To my knowledge, from what I've seen thus far, they have been the same. So I've always attributed the Phoenix Force to Jean Grey, or even the Phoenix Force originating from Jean Grey. Like, I didn't even know it was like a cosmic entity. Like, I had seen things like that happen, but I always thought it originated from Jean Grey. And what you're saying is...
No, it's totally different.
Did you know that, Spence?
It's a completely separate thing.
I did know that, but like...
whatever.
It's like a mythological being from space.
Yeah, I knew they were separate things. I just didn't understand how they were separate or like how it was supposed to be portrayed as separate when like...
Yeah.
Based on what I'm seeing, like, so the Phoenix is all angsty over someone else's life? Like, I don't get it.
I didn't know that. All right. Well, that makes a little bit more sense. Just in terms of the character itself, not the movie. The movie's still like, okay.
Yeah, and it's one of those like, it's also hard because when one of the dominant themes of this movie is the concept of family, and specifically like your found family, right? Like who you end up associating with closely as you grow up and you find people with similar interests or abilities or whatever. So the X-Men are like the definitive found family.
Yeah.
There are a heck of a lot of them in the comic books. There's like thousands of characters. And so that being one of the dominant themes, and that was, this was true of the original story as well. When the Phoenix possesses Jean and basically turns her evil, it's heartbreaking. It's a heart-wrenching thing because of how connected they are. But when you try to do that with this franchise, the way that it's been told here, where you've been jumping a decade at a time from First Class to Days of Future Past to Apocalypse to now, so you've gone from the 60s to the 70s to the 80s to the 90s, the characters here in the 90s, you've known some of them since the 60s, although they haven't seemed to age. And you know, you've known a few of them since the 80s, but they've kind of been thrown into the middle of a story. They're not the foundational characters the way that they really were when this story was in print. So you've got like one of the founding members of the print X-Men, Jean Grey.
Yeah.
Arguably the very first one that Xavier ever found and started training, and they have a similar power set. Turning into a bad guy, essentially, and the rest of the founding and secondary founding members are the ones dealing with it, and they're horrified. I mean, it's like, what do we do? Kill our friend?
Yeah.
That can't be the answer, but nobody can stop her, and like, it's high drama, right? But here, you're going for those same themes, except you haven't had as long with most of these characters, and they've been the ones that you're going to get the most payout off of are the ones that you've seen the least. So Cyclops and Jean Grey, I think definitely Storm, Wolverine in the comics, but he's not currently in he's, Hugh Jackman does not make a cameo in this movie, by the way.
Thank God.
Anybody who's looking for that, he's not in it. So what you've got left is Xavier, sort of Magneto, but he's kind of only in the second half of the movie anyway.
Yeah.
Mystique, who's only in the first third of the movie, and Beast. Those are your legacy characters that you literally, they should look 30 years older now than when they started. Of course, I don't know what happened with the Logics team on the back end of all this, because I'm like, Magneto is a Holocaust survivor in the 90s, and he looks like he's 40 years old.
He does.
There's something that doesn't add up there. So, like, makeup, that I think there was a lack of realism there, but also that's a hard group of characters to follow.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting set of decisions that have led to this point, because the emotional buy-in is almost nil. Like, the psychological buy-in, like, oh, do I find this interesting? Absolutely. Is it an interesting story? The woman just got possessed by something from outer space. Yeah, it's an interesting story. She's doing some crazy things. She's killing people, which she didn't before, and it doesn't really make sense.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, there's a lot that it's not really super poignant, because this is only the second time that we've seen this version of Jean Grey. The second time that we've seen this version of Storm and of Cyclops. Because they showed up in X-Men Apocalypse.
Yeah.
So there's not really been a lot of time to build for the audience to build rapport with these characters. Yeah. And to care at the level. Really, it's just sort of like, oh, this is just like good guy became bad guy and they've got to put her down kind of thing. So all the emotional heft that made the original story so good is really, you can't do it here. You haven't had enough time. The dynamic hasn't matured for the audience.
Speaking of Magneto, you did mention him in terms of being in the film. I had a question. So, in the cartoons, Genosha is a much wilder and larger place than what I remember it being.
Than like a little sandbar on a pond?
Yeah.
That's what it seems like. It's a country. It's like Madagascar.
Yeah.
It's a country.
It is. It's
huge. An island nation.
Wait, so that was supposed to be Genosha?
They never name dropped it in the movie, but yes.
Oh.
In the stories that have come out in the news leading up to the movie, that's supposed to represent Genosha. Yeah.
Okay.
And he kind of has a beef with the military when they're coming. He's like, you guys aren't supposed to be here. That's the agreement I made with the government.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the closest you ever get.
Hmm.
Also, Genosha had a much different origin story, so to speak, than what you would even want to tackle in one of these movies. Because they're basically slaves. Mutants are slaves. The government is owning them and like loaning them out to people. And then the X-Men and others put a stop to it and then reform the entire country. So it's a very loaded and hard to tell story. You wouldn't get through it in 2 hours if it was the focus. Mm. And clearly, with a title like Dark Phoenix, ain't no time for that to be the focus here.
Yeah. And I was wondering about that because, like I said, I remember it from the cartoons. I remember them talking about it. But I remember it being much different than just it being like you said, like a sandbar.
Like
with
a commune. He's got like a hippie commune.
It's like, exactly. It's like a hippie refuge.
Yeah.
Like everybody's living in these, like, you know, train freighters or all these little train cars and, you know, growing fruits and vegetables and living life on their own currency of love and peace. And what it seemed like.
I mean, hey, he's tried everything else by this point.
He has. And I think it's something to say, like, overall with the entirety of the film, like the film, obviously, because the film does, you know, span close to almost 2 hours, it's like an hour and 54 minutes. The film does take a good length of time to get to the storyline and get to the points of like the bigger beats. But I do think one of the things this film does suffer for is having a little bit too many lulls in between, in my personal opinion. Like, I think after each section of action, there's just the lull kind of takes a little bit too long for me.
And there's not really that much action.
I wasn't going to say that. But
this movie, I don't know why they did this. It's a bookend.
Yeah.
You've got action in the very beginning, and you've got action in the very end, and all through the middle of it, it's sort of this treading water.
Yeah.
It feels like treading water, and I don't say that as a total slam. It's just, to me, it's a very interesting choice to make with a movie named after Dark Phoenix. Like, Dark Phoenix is not good. She's bad. She's very bad news. And she really doesn't do all the diabolical things here that she should.
Yeah. Because it seems as though, like, the Dark Phoenix power itself is keen on destroying planets and destroying civilizations, because according to the movie, the force, the cosmic force or whatever it is, had destroyed the planet of the alien race, which I believe, because it's never mentioned in the movie, not once. I was like, is this the Shi'ar? Are they talking about the Shi'ar? I don't know names. I just know Chad's mentioned the Shi'ar. Is this like nonstop? And apparently they're called the Dabari?
Yeah, these ones are a lesser known alien race.
Okay.
Although they're very, they have a lot of fortitude. It's really hard to hurt them.
Yeah, they're like, yeah, they just, none of them dropped at all. Except if they got hit with like the big old 50 caliber gun, then they went down.
Yeah.
So that was really interesting. But like, just with the overall storyline and the assumption that this force has the ability to take the entire, like, take over an entire planet, I was waiting for something like that to happen in this movie, and it never really got to that level. Like, a lot of it just seemed very personal in terms of, like, the fights and the little battles and the little arguments, the disputes. They were all very personal. It was either her versus Magneto, or her versus, you know, Cyclops, or her versus some one individual.
Her versus Magneto was pretty fun, where they're fighting over the helicopter.
Yeah,
that was a fun one. Like, well, okay, that's an odd choice, but I'm enjoying it.
It's like a tug of war over who had more power.
Yeah, totally.
So that was really interesting. But I think that's one of the things this film suffers from. And you bring up a good point. Like, there's not as much action as you would want to see in a movie like this in between. That first sequence where she gets the power and the last sequence where everything kind of comes to that big old crescendo. Yeah, in between.
And honestly, there's something so unexpected, I guess I would say, about the way that the characters are positioned in relation to each other. Because in the comics, yeah, she goes off her rocker when she's possessed by this entity, and they're trying to save their friend, and they're not succeeding. And I think for a while she actually leaves Earth and destroys a world after all, and then comes back, and that's why she's put on trial. I think I could be misquoting it. It's been a long time.
Going blow off steam.
but then, like, and also in the comics, Xavier is called to the carpet. Eventually, that's a very modern development, I guess you could say, where like his motives are suspect. Like, did you do this really just all for yourself and your own notoriety? That's never the way he was written in the earlier days, but that's definitely been like a refrain that we've heard several times in the last 15 years or so.
Yeah.
So they introduce that story thread here at the closing of this quartet of films. So just like juxtaposing that in there also, like, maybe he's not such a good guy, maybe we shouldn't trust him, that's actually a whole other story that you want to tell. Putting it in here with all this mess just muddies the waters. It makes for a lot of,
wait, is there an actual story in that?
Dramatic tension of them not trusting Xavier anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, totally.
Oh.
They've done that more than once.
Okay.
So, but that, again, that's a much more contemporary read of the character. And it's frankly, I mean, you crank out an issue of these things every month, and if you've got multiple titles, like, you need more things to talk about. Like, you need more story points. But in a 2-hour movie, you don't.
Yeah.
And then having that, like, pivot moment coming with the death of Mystique, who is a very different character in this sequence of movies than in the first trilogy or in the comics. The first trilogy version of Mystique was a lot closer to the way that she behaves in the comics. This version, the Jennifer Lawrence version, is a bit bewildering because it's just, she's fundamentally different. And the role that she plays in the landscape of the team, it's almost like she's supposed to be the Jean Grey, because she's the one that inspired so many of them to become X-Men, and she's their leader and whatever. And so when she dies, it means something. And that's all fine, because it's decently consistent with what they've put into that character in this telling of the story. But at the same time, it's like, but then Jean Grey going bad means less, because you've had the good-hearted, good-natured character killed. But in the comics, it was the good-hearted, good-natured character saves everyone from exploding on a space shuttle.
Mm-hmm.
And then they thought she was dead, and then when she came back, she was possessed by something. Like, that's where, but it was all within one character. It wasn't this character possessed by an alien cosmic force kills the one that's like the heart of the team, and then they all don't know what to do. Like, it's just, it's a very different dynamic.
Yeah.
And I'm not entirely sure why they did it the way they did it. Because then later on, you get other dynamics, like, are Cyclops, Storm, and Nightcrawler actually trying to kill people?
Yeah.
Like, they're all kind of trying to kill the aliens. And you've not really seen that either. So it's sort of like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
What offshoot of the universe did this version of the story come from? Because there's no real discussion about it. There's no, like, it's just... In the beginning, they're going to go save astronauts, and at the end, they're like flat out murdering aliens.
Oh, yeah.
Or trying to. And it's like, where did their turn come from?
Yeah, because you have a Storm legitimately like blasting people with huge lightning bolts. You have Cyclops blasting people with his ray, and then you have this moment where Nightcrawler like fully does the whole like Man of Steel scream and yell, and then... jump into action kind of thing, like where he changes up and goes from like being this mild-mannered fighter for good and everything to this crazy killer who's utilizing like the power of his tail.
Yeah,
it's insane, and it's like, this is different. Okay, like I haven't seen this kind of craziness since like X-Men 2
when he was like possessed. I mean, he had been injected with something, and somebody else was controlling his actions.
Yeah, exactly. And so I thought that was a little, for me personally, I thought that was a little too much, especially for Nightcrawler, who always seemed to kind of shy away from that kind of violence in cartoons. Like, it never seemed to be something that he would be capable of doing. So that was a really interesting take. And then
there's no real time to explain it. That's the other thing. You spend so much time focused on other things that you're just like, oh, and now it's time for them to fight on a train. So they're all going to just go for it. Total. Full tilt. No questions asked. Like, the chips are down and they're fighting. You know, like, I get it. But at the same time, it would have been helpful to get to know them a little bit better before they do that.
Yeah, like, if there would have been some type of information as to why that moment sent him over the edge.
Yeah. And in typical fashion, you've got not only Jennifer Lawrence, but you've also got Evan Peters' character, Quicksilver, out of the running pretty quick. Not because they killed him, but because he can't fight. So, like, he's just gone from the story.
He is.
When he
no
showed
ceremony.
Up at the end of the movie, I was like, oh, right, you're in this movie still.
Oh, that's right. Because he's like, oh, no running in the halls. I'm like,
yeah.
It didn't even dawn on me, like, who is that guy?
No, like, that was the part I was like, where have you been for the last 2 hours?
Yeah.
He was on bed rest or something. Because he gets knocked down from... He just literally gets knocked down from running.
He just falls.
Fast. And apparently that bruises and beats him up pretty bad. And they carry him off I almost saw the Quinjet. The X-Wing. Is it called the X-Wing?
Yeah.
And he's in this like stretcher, and then you don't see him again.
Yeah. Also, I feel like, you know, if he was running and tripped over himself, like, the same thing would happen. And I feel like he should be able to recover from, like, tripping.
Totally.
Because that means that's Quicksilver's, like, massive defect is tripping over either himself or random things.
We're battling Quicksilver. Quick, get the speed strips.
Get out the Jackson Legos.
Because doesn't he necessarily... I mean, I'm no comic book expert, but I would assume that he has the similar type of ability as, like, the Flash, who has, like, a sped-up metabolism.
And, yes, and can heal fast and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, so, like, a little tumble like that.
Not to mention the fact that in X-Men Apocalypse, which a lot of people didn't like, I understand, I get it. I know what's not to like about it. But they started you down the path of, he's actually Magneto's son. I mean, you knew that from before, but he started pursuing that truth. And now you've had a gap of however many years between Apocalypse and Dark Phoenix, and there's been no development that any of us can see of that thread. And this is your last chance to do that. And they did zero with it.
Yeah, and
like nothing at all.
That kind of seems like that was a huge miss on their part. Like this being, quite frankly, the last Fox Marvel film.
Yeah.
You would have thought, like, all right, let's go, you know, all chips down, hands down, everything just put on the table. Like, you realize, oh, you know, Quicksilver's the son of Magneto. Oh, you know, Mystique actually had a daughter, but, you know, she's over here or whatever. Or, yeah, like, a lot of these little revelations that would have been great fan service for this, like, last hurrah, I think would have been really suitable.
Yeah.
So, any last thoughts, anything before we wrap this up, Spence?
So...
Here's where the list comes out.
Lay it out on us, buddy.
No, I was while I was watching this movie, and like we were back at Gene's dad's house.
Yeah,
like I was like, this feels oddly familiar, and I'm not happy. And so, like, I went digging around afterwards. I was like, they did this in X3. We were
at they did this in X3.
It's like all of this has happened before, and when they go and visit
her
again.
At her house from her childhood.
Yeah, it's kind of like a dog with a bone, right? Like, just I think that they would have benefited from, even if Kinberg was in the director's seat, they would have benefited from fresh eyes writing the script, because I think one of the things that you definitely do feel in this movie is a lot of familiarity.
Yeah.
Like, your ability to innovate with the characters is dry. You've dried up that well a bit, and it's like kind of more of the same, which again doesn't make it terrible, but it doesn't make it great.
Right.
Yeah, because even the last battle sequence does share somewhat of a slight parallel to the last battle sequence in X3 in The Last Stand, because you got all these people that are fighting in this like dusty area, like this kind of battlefield, you know, looking thing, and they're just all coming out of nowhere, and Jean Grey is just kind of going nuts or whatever. That seemed very similar to how X3 kind of ended in that last sequence. So
yeah, kind of.
I was just like,
also
harumph.
This movie kind of like puts up the idea that Jean Grey is a bad telepath. Because, like, part of her turn, like, near the end of the movie, is, like, reading Xavier's thoughts on things that she read her, like, from her dad's mind again, but just seeing his perspective on it. But I'm like, couldn't you have gotten most of this information from your dad because he was talking to Charles Xavier? Like, why did you cut at such a convenient point for you to just go down this one route when you could have just listened to the whole conversation? But that's just...
But no.
Yeah. Like,
yeah, the Jean Grey of these movies has always been a bit sloppier than the Jean Grey from the comics.
That's really true.
What about you? Or the cartoon, I guess.
What about you, Chad? Any last thoughts? Any last issues? Highlights?
I think... just to point out a couple of other things, we've not talked at all about Jessica Chastain.
That is true.
So Jessica Chastain is...
Oh my gosh.
Actually plays two parts in this movie.
Yes.
When you meet her, she's a human named, I don't remember, Margaret, at a dinner party at her house. And then the dog's barking in the distance, and she's the one that leaves the dinner party to go see what the dog's barking about. And then that's when these aliens, well, do away with her and then take her identity. So then she's the alien masquerading as her for like all of 10 seconds before she like leaves the entire family and goes and meets up with other people and does other things. But they are an alien race that is pursuing the Phoenix Force because it destroyed their world, and they want to either destroy it or control it. And now that it's in Jean Grey, and now that it has a host, they think that they can actually then control it to remake the Earth for them, basically destroy the Earth and make it fresh for what's left of their people. And while that's not, it's not unusual to have an alien race tied in with a story about the Phoenix, because again, this is like a giant cosmic force that cruises the starways, right? Yeah. Like it's an interstellar thing with its own personality, so to speak, and a lot of cultures are really mad at it and scared of it because it's destroyed a lot of worlds and a lot of peoples.
Yeah.
So having an alien group in the story is not unusual. Again, this one is kind of unusual because they're not super famous. And really, I didn't think it was ultimately necessary. It was just one of those other things that's like, just because you're supposed to do this, like Jean Grey as the Phoenix, you could do a whole lot more with the characters you already had.
Yeah.
Or by introducing somebody that you teased earlier, like, I don't know, Mr. Sinister. But that's a missed opportunity too, because, and not that I'm dogging, you know, Jessica Chastain, but they weren't really very interesting characters to me until mm-hmm. you got to the battle sequence on the train.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you find out that they're basically like Terminators. You can't kill them. Like, seriously. You can't get rid of them. They come back.
Like cockroaches.
So that kind of made them as a unit, as a whole, it made the aliens interesting.
Yeah.
Her as the individual leader of the aliens, I found her to be very uninteresting.
Yeah. The whole monotone, like, robotic way she was portraying this alien who was pretending to be a human, that seemed very much like overly done. We've already seen that. People, you know, doing the whole awkwardly standing there, sitting there, talking there. I mean, it just seemed like there could have been a little bit more personality to her that would have made a much more interesting character for somebody who already, like, I checked out the moment I was like, oh, she's not really doing much. And
she didn't really have a turn way that, like, I don't remember his name, the Skrull leader in Captain Marvel, right?
Oh, yeah.
He, at first, you think they're the bad guys, and then you realize, oh, they've actually been exploited, and they're on the run, and they're in danger, and now all of his actions make total sense. And you have an opportunity for compassion, which makes it awkward. Talos, thank you. It makes it awkward to fight him anymore, right? Yeah. But here, their story contains a similar element, right? Somebody destroyed my homeworld, and now I don't know what to do for my people, but maybe destroy this thing or control it. So it can't do that to anybody else ever again. That's not the way that they do it. Like that, they're like, oh, okay, well, how do I get control of that thing to exploit this world? Like, mine was exploited. Like, it's just, you lose a whole layer of depth to that character to where that's just a cardboard cutout now. Like, that's just a mustache twirling bad guy. There's nothing distinctive about her. There's not really much relatable about her. And then, you know, by the time she and Jean are fighting each other for control of the Phoenix, you're like, okay, well, I don't really care which one of you gets control or if it flies back out into outer space.
Right.
It's cool to watch.
Yeah, and I think that's one that's like it was okay to watch, but it just seemed like a real big letdown to what you were hoping as a climactic end fight. Like, you're looking for this, like, going back to X-Men Apocalypse. That was a whole drag out big battle that led to a pretty large crescendo of, like, Jean Grey mentally battling against Apocalypse and having this whole thing going all out. That was cool. That was what you had, culminated in the film in terms of experiences. This one, I was like, it turned into like a cat fight almost. Like, they just had each other by the throats, and then Jean, like, shoots them, you know, into the sky, and then.
Yeah, and it wasn't like, they used a lot of effects.
A lot of
their effects budget happens in, like, the last 10 minutes of the movie. Maybe the last 20, because the train sequence does have a lot of effects going on there too. Some of them are flying above the train, some of them are, like, teleporting from one car to another. There's a lot going on there too, but I think that the other thing that was really interesting to me, having read a couple of stories about why they did reshoots and everything, and how, well, we realized that totally separate from the people running the MCU, we had something very similar to Infinity War.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed to recalculate and redo some of it. And I'm like, so by the time you get to that ending sequence where she's, well, she's dusting the bad guys.
Yeah.
Like literally almost the exact same look. And I'm like, okay, so what did it look like before? You changed it so that it was less like Infinity War, but it still looks exactly like the effect done in Infinity War. So what happened before?
What happened before is she snapped her fingers and then all of them started dissolving.
Yeah. This one she has to do a little bit of like air foo, you know? Ka-chow, pow, and they dust away when she points at them or whatever.
And it, mind you... I don't know, man. It seemed like a really big letdown in that for an opportunity to really see something cool in this particular movie for the ending. And you know, mind you, it is still better than some of the worst films in the franchise.
Totally.
But it's not as good as where it could have been. And, you know, that's honestly just the bare truth of it all. So wrapping up this episode, we're going to go ahead and go around the table. And I'm going to start with Spence. Spence, does the film pass or fail, and how many monocles?
Like, the film passes for being better than X3. but, like, there's just a lot of, like, you're just sitting there and you're like, okay, like, when are we gonna, let's go, people. Like, I don't have all day to sit around waiting for, like, the fight sequences, which I thought were actually kind of good for the most part.
Yeah.
So, like, there's not really that much that was, like, holding me there, so I'm gonna give it, like, a 2.8.
Okay. All right. The film passes for me. I did enjoy the film in its entirety. I do think there were a lot of good elements to the film. I just think the timing of it all and the story, which seemed to be stretched out quite a bit, could have been done in less time. And I think if they sped up some of the opportunities in between, it may have made for a better film altogether in terms of consistency. In terms of monocles, I am going to give the film 2.5 solely based on how great Nicholas Hoult really has excelled as a character in the film as well as an actor. I mean, knowing where he started from and seeing where he's at now, it's just great seeing that progression as a, you know, as Beast altogether, you know, because he's going to grow up to be Kelsey Grammer. but also because of the fact that now that I give it 2.5 also for the fact that now that the franchise is transitioning hands, the possibility of us beginning to see what is to come and the amount of work and time and effort that's going to be invested into the films now, this momentous film marks the ending of also another great chapter in our as fans lives altogether. So, Chad, what about you?
True. Don't forget New Mutants is still allegedly coming out next year.
What?
It's supposed to be.
Okay. We'll see if that happens. Because... yeah, the scuttlebutt behind the scenes is that it's a hot mess and they haven't been able to really fix it, but we'll see. So there may be one more, and we know at the very least Deadpool will live on.
That is true.
Yeah, I think for this film, one of the things I think was a tremendous benefit to me, because again, I grew up with these characters. Like,
yeah.
I felt as a child, I almost felt like some of them were friends of mine. Like if I had an imaginary friend, which I didn't, it would be one of the X-Men. That's how much I like read the comics, watched the cartoon show, wanted to see a live action movie and was super excited when I was a high schooler and it finally came out. That being said, it's hard for me to distance myself from what I know and then see what I'm seeing and just appreciate what it is versus what I wanted it to be.
Yeah.
I had the benefit, though, of going to this movie with my fiance and her mother, who was in town for the bridal shower, because we get married in a couple of weeks, and very excited about that.
Yeah.
And they both agreed that they thought the movie was really interesting, and they generally understood the story that was being told, which sometimes when you're talking about a genre property, it's super difficult for people who aren't familiar with it to really feel like it was accessible.
Yeah.
So I'm letting that input kind of weigh in my mind a little bit because I didn't necessarily get a lot of what I was wanting from the story. but it was a complete story in its own sense. It wasn't hard to follow. It just did things differently than I expected. So I'm going to pass the movie, and I'm going to give it a solid 3.
Well, there you go. Well, that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Film Philosophers. Remember, you can let us know what you thought. Did you get a chance to check out the film? What are your thoughts on the film? Let us know on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmphilosophers and our Twitter page at twitter.com/philosophy101. As we mentioned, this is Chad's last consistent day of being a film philosopher. That does not mean he will be gone completely, but it just means that you will probably not hear him for a couple weeks in between his visits. So we will definitely be having him come back. For those that don't know, myself and Chad started this podcast a few years ago, and we did it out of the heart of us having such a love for movies and cinema and being able to have a platform to talk about it and just share. So from this table to Chad, thank you for being a part of this journey and helping create something that, God willing, continues on, although Spence is over here saying he's gonna wreck it like Wreck-It Ralph. So
I didn't say I was gonna wreck it. I just saying our dynamic is very different than yours and Chad's dynamic,
and that's gonna make for great new episodes that we're looking forward to. But just to give credit,
it's
where
gonna
credit
be fun
is due.
I'm gonna enjoy listening.
Chad, from bottom of my heart, thank you for being just everything to this podcast.
Yeah, so it's been a very fun ride. 165 episodes.
That's true. That's
plus some other tie-in content. I mean, that's a good run.
Real quick, and I know this is kind of putting you on the spot, but do you have any favorite episodes that you remember?
Do you have a speech prepared?
No, I don't. I don't. But I was thinking about this the other day, and honestly, this is so stupid. This is so dumb. My favorite episode that I ever participated in was the Sharknado one.
I was literally going to tell you. I was like, because my favorite episode with you probably had to be, as much as I hated that movie, the Sharknado episode, because of how, like, I was listening back to the episodes the other day, and I was listening to that episode, and I could not recreate, you know, the amount of joy that came out of your mouth when you were watching how much pain I was being put through because we had to talk about this movie. Like, it was like, I can't recreate that, but hey, you had a good time.
It was one of, like, maybe two films that I didn't see before reviewing them. That one I was honest about. The other one I wasn't. And it was very recent. But Sharknado 6. 6?
Yeah.
Yeah, Sharknado 6. That episode, I had so much fun with that. I mean, whatever random, like, what, Doritos commercials or Dr. Pepper or what, Taco Bell, that's
Taco
what it was.
Bell. I remember.
And then the drag queen that I had not even heard it in the original. It was just like, the way that the GIF worked, it looked like they were saying bye.
Oh my gosh.
So that episode was so much fun for me. I have a lot of favorites. That one was the most unique. For me.
What about you, Spence? I know this is putting you on the spot as well, but do you have any favorite
episodes?
Yeah,
I'm not leaving. I'm here next week.
No, I mean with Chad. Any favorite episodes with Chad?
Oh, one of my favorites, because this movie was dumb, was, what's it called? It was the last Maze Runner movie.
The Scorch Trials?
No.
The Death Cure.
Yeah, that's it. That movie was terrible, but I did have fun talking about it with you guys.
Well,
I still remember Mother with this guy.
The very first one was Spencer. That's right. Well, as we said, this is not goodbye, but this is see you later for
that's
Chad.
Right.
And we plan to bring him back as often as we can, as available as he becomes. And so this is going to be great.
I'm not hanging up my monocle.
He's not.
I'm keeping this monocle, and I'm bringing it back.
Plus, this is all for good things. Chad is going on his next chapter of life with being married.
That's right, I'm getting married.
And that whole thing. So, you know what? We only wish him the best. We wish him luck. We wish him good fortune. And
thank you.
Here's to that. Right, Spence?
Yeah, of course.
Well, I'm just making sure because you're quiet.
What? No, I'm going to be against the whole thing. That's ridiculous.
I can't see you behind this screen. So
you guys are going to be so much fun.
I don't know if you're
to.
Like putting your hand in your fist like, yeah, it's you
gonna,
better come back.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't know what you're doing behind the screen, buddy.
Hey. That look.
So, moving forward with great and awesome content and plenty of things to look forward to in the future, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.